May I please support James Cowan appearing on behalf of the Secretary of Department of Veterans Affairs?
You get just a little bit closer.
Oh, pardon me. The issue on appeal is whether the court should affirm the June 16, 2005 Board of Veterans Appeals decision which denied entitlement to service connection for PTSD. Secretary says that Title 38, Section 3.304F applies in this case, and as applies, did not have an impermissible retroactive effect, and that thus the board's application of 3.304F in this case was proper, and the board correctly found that VA had complied with the provisions of the regulation, and including its finding that appellant had been notified.
Let me just get this clear. Mr. Carpenter focused most of his argument on whether or not the regulation should apply. And you're saying, fine, it does apply, I'm not contesting. You're saying that they did apply.
That's correct, Your Honor. In this case, the board did apply the revised version of 3.304, including the 3.304F3 in this case, as is indicated in the statement of the case and the remand of December 2003, as well as the board decision on appeal. In this case, the board properly applied 3.304, and in finding that there is a plausible basis for the board to find that appellant had indeed been notified of the alternative provisions. In this case, appellant filed a claim in July 2000. In September 2000, appellant was provided a PTSD questionnaire, which listed alternative forms of evidence that could support his claim. That's a record 640. That provision mirrors the provisions of M21-1, which ultimately were revised and included into 38 CFR 3.304F. And again, in December 2000, he was also informed in the body of the letter that he could provide alternative forms of evidence. Subsequent to those two notices, the regulation was revised in March of 2002. And again, that incorporated the manual provisions of M21-1, which had been indicated that the VA was bound to follow in the cases of Weyhaar and Patton. And subsequent to that change, the appellant continued to receive notice regarding the revised regulation. In September 2002, he was issued a statement of case, as your honor had noted, that indicated the various forms of evidence and examples of behavioral changes.
If I can interject there, we don't have a body of law as to what adequate notice in 3304F context is. You know, is timing a problem? What form does notice have to take? What are the prejudice rules apply? Who has a burden? All these kinds of questions that we've been wrestling with in the BCAA context. So just to play hypothetical, in the BCAA context, a statement of the case would not be considered a notice document because it's a decisional document. So how does that provide adequate notice to Mr. Gallegos?
Again, the Secretary is not relying solely on the statement of the case. We're also indicating the notice given in the December 2003 remand, and more importantly, the
decisional document.
But more importantly, the June 2003 hearing, in which the representative for appellant reiterated the revised provisions of 3.304F. An appellant was in need of question regarding any sources of evidence that he was aware of, in the context of providing alternative forms to verify his claims. And again, the ability for him to submit alternative forms of evidence was noted by the hearing officer at the close of that hearing. That can be seen in the record at 853 and 856. So the Secretary's contention is that with the notice that was provided prior to the adjudication, it is essentially the same notification that he would be entitled to following the revision of the regulation. The September 2000, PTSD questionnaire, record at 640 through 642, contains the examples listed in the regulation of alternative forms of evidence, as well as examples of behavioral changes that can stand in as, or that can provide a basis for verifying stressors. So it's the Secretary's position that that notice, combined with subsequent hearing, testimony, and interaction, provided appellant with sufficient notice of his ability to support his claim with alternative forms of evidence.
How do you respond to Mr. Carpenter's argument that the notice that he received doesn't comply with that contemplated in Bradford?
Your Honor, I would indicate that the VA's current procedure is very similar to what occurred in this case, in the sense that VA's current provision of, or current method of informing the veteran in this case, is by through providing a questionnaire which requests details of appellant's claimed personal trauma, and then goes and it lays out the alternative forms of evidence and also examples of behavior change. So in terms of what is the type of notice that's required in this case, appellant received that both prior to the adjudication and in the form of the questionnaire that he received in September 2000, as well as the December 2000 letter, and then subsequently in the June 2003 hearing.
I'm not sure if I understand Mr. Carpenter's argument correctly, but it seems to me what he was arguing is because the Bradford case, Mr. Bradford's appeal was remanded such that it wasn't originally complied with, that he was almost in a different circumstance than somebody who was applying for the first time, that somehow needed to be articulated that there is a change going on here and that creates some additional obligation than if it was a brand new claim.
Respectfully, Your Honor, the Secretary's position is that there was no need to, or there is no requirement for a new notification. And again, I believe, Your Honor, that in Bradford, what was at issue was the court found that the board had failed to make a finding as to whether or not a parent had actually been notified in that case, and therefore remand was appropriate. In this case, at record of 12, the board clearly did make a finding that a parent had been notified in this case, and that VA had complied with the notice requirements of revised 3.304F.
What notice, or going back to something I articulated earlier, does VA believe that the case law pertaining to BCAA notice should be translated into a 3.304F context, for example, regarding timing errors or can't be contained in the decisional document, or should it have a separate body of law to assess the adequacy of notice?
I think that it is somewhat of a hybrid, Your Honor, in the sense that I think we can look to, it's most certainly separate and distinct from the notice in the BCAA context. But we can look to our understanding of the curing of notice defects in such a case where a subsequent re-adjudication following proper notice would be...
Well, the issue was proper notice. I think the question was focused on whether or not proper notice could be provided in a separate case, or whether proper notice needed to be provided in a separate document. My understanding of the Federal Circuit is it was concerned that a decisional document, you weren't alerted to the idea of notice being provided, and therefore it needed to be in a separate statement, at least under the BCAA. I think the question is, should that be the case here? That if it's provided in the statement of the case, forgetting all of the factors for a second, is that sufficient notice, or does it need to be provided in a separate document?
Well, Your Honor, I think that as it is not explicitly laid out in statute, I think that it is for the board again to make a determination, or for VA to make a determination that that appellant has been informed. Should they rely on a statement of the case, I don't think that would be outside of their purview if they find that that is.
Why doesn't the rationale of the Federal Circuit's holding with regard to notice of indecisional documents apply to this notice also?
Well, I would argue that if the, should the court find that, should the court find that, SOC is not, I think that it would be within the court's bounds to find that SOC is not proper, or would not provide proper notice. But again, on the facts of this case, we can look outside those documents and see both in the prior letters in September and December 2000, as well as the hearing testimony in June 2006, that, June 2003, that appellant.
I understand. I think the question was the question, or the process question.
How do you respond to the appellant's arguments regarding the viability of CARDIS and the distinction that he offers today between a statutory or regulatory change?
I think that in the Secretary's position is that CARDIS has been completely overruled by the Federal Circuit. To the extent that the court is analyzing the retroactivity of a statute, the court is required to apply the Princess Cruz's test, and as was laid out in Rodriguez. So in making a consideration for whether or not either a statute or a regulation has a permissible or impermissible retroactive effect, the court must apply the test laid out by the Federal Circuit in Princess Cruz's, as opposed to a finding or the holding in CARDIS that if there's a benefit to the veteran, that the regulation or the statute should apply. Again, the court must consider in making that determination that it should be applied, it must apply the test for determining whether or not there's an impermissible retroactive effect.
But the question is, the CARDIS decision, then we recognize the fact that a veteran might very well choose to abandon the service claim if there were a more favorable regulatory scheme enacted, allowing the veteran basically to start afresh, utilizing the benefit of that more favorable regulatory scheme. And then the court in CARDIS wisely, in my opinion, to say, that's silly. It doesn't make any sense to require the veteran to go back and start afresh if he has or she has a more favorable regulatory scheme. Now, obviously, that decision was not viewed in that context by the Federal Circuit. But it seems to me that we ought to come to grips with the reality that the veteran could have had, as you heard, claim at some point in time, refile utilizing the more favorable regulatory scheme. So just some general thoughts on that would be helpful.
Certainly, Your Honor. In terms of making the determination as to whether or not a rule should apply, beneficial or not, I think that, again, although there's a possibility that the appellant will or a claimant could go back and refile, the court still must consider in a particular case whether or not there was an impermissible effect. In general, VA will be applying the regulation that's more beneficial to a claimant, or that is beneficial to a claimant, as was done in the INSA case. Insofar as the appellant did receive the benefit of the regulation in this case, or the beneficial change in this regulation, insofar as he was given a notice and given a remand in order to re-adjudicate following the provisions and the promulgations of the new regulation.
Well, if that is the practice, what is the Secretary's problem with CARDIS as originally constituted?
Well, again, Your Honor, in making a determination as to whether a regulation can properly be applied, again, the court as indicated by the Federal Circuit, is required to take account of the factors laid out in Lansgraf and in Princess Cruises. So in making a determination, if an appellant is arguing that he should receive the benefit of a revised regulation, should the revision in the regulation be more beneficial, appellant could, he could make the, he could raise the argument that that regulation should be applied, and then the court would have to, again, apply the test and review the test laid out in Princess Cruises and Rodriguez to make a determination as to whether or not that could properly be applied in that case.
Just as a general observation, it seems to me that, that you take commercial concepts and other non-veteran regulatory schemes and try to graft them to the very unique system that we have here in the Veterans Community. But that's an observation, not a question.
Well, for an observation, it seems to me that underlying Carnes was the concept that the Secretary wrote the regulations and could have said it was or was not retroactive, as well as the beneficial system for the veteran. If it was more beneficial, the court said, apply the most beneficial. Some of the underlying concepts is pointing up by Judge Lance. The Federal Circuit said, we got two parties here, one is a veteran and one is a secretary, and you have to look at the interests of both. And if it's retroactive with regard to one and negative, maybe you don't do it, and vice versa. So it doesn't apply in this particular case. Because you are applying disabled, et cetera. You could have a situation where the secretary, it would be, well, Rodriguez's case itself, it would be a situation where the secretary changed his regulations, and the Federal Circuit looked at that and felt that because the person that applied when that was, as they viewed it, the application by the secretary, which makes you wonder about Green, doesn't it? But anyway, we have those differences. And therefore they didn't see any expectations with regard to that. Anyway, that gets into a lot of different issues. I have no further questions for the Secretary. They don't either. You have 12 minutes. What would you like to do with it?
I don't close your eye.
Very smart.
The Secretary argues that the court should affirm the June 2005 board decision. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Carver, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. The government suggests that the board in its June 2005 decision applied 3.304F and it made a specific finding of fact in that regard. As I reviewed the findings of fact contained on page 2, I don't see any reference made to such findings of fact. And it would seem to me that if, in fact, they had applied 3.304F and, in fact, had gone back and attempted to do, as has been inferred by this court in its questions, to have given him notice and given him an opportunity to provide that information, then they would have articulated that. If you go to the text of the decision at page 12, it actually begins in the closing paragraph of page 11, where the board begins by acknowledging that Mr. Galeos had alleged that he was subjected to sexual assault or assaults while on active duty, and then notes the ability under the regulation to corroborate that through other sources. In the middle of that paragraph at the top of page 12, the board correctly states that the law provides that the VA will not deny a PTSD claim on the basis of in-service personal assault without first advising that the advising the claimant that the evidence from sources other than the veteran service records or evidence of behavioral changes may constitute credible supporting evidence of the stressor and allowing him or her the opportunity to furnish that type of evidence or advise the VA of the potential sources of such evidence. And then it goes on to make another statement about the submission of that and cites the 3.304F but not F3 and then concludes with the sweeping statement that the veteran has been informed
that he could submit evidence from sources other than service records in support of his PTSD claim. Now, that's not a specific finding that he had been informed. To the contrary, that's a self-serving determination that the provisions as previously described had been complied with. But what it does, at least in the view of Mr. Galeos, is to confirm for this court that there was no good faith effort to really apply retroactively 3.304F3, but to simply go through some sort of motion or a ceremony to, as it were, pretend as though they had, without doing what is required. The law provides the VA will not deny the claim without first advising the claimant. Now, the court has suggested that there is potential advice within an SOC, within a board remand, and I suggest that clearly this regulation has to be read to require specific notice, and that this kind of notice within decisional documents has been rejected in the context of ECAA and should be rejected in the context of this regulation.
So if we reject it, how do you get beyond actual knowledge demonstrated by a representative at a board hearing?
Well, that's why we have to go back to Carnes, Your Honor, because this is not a question of actual knowledge.
Actual knowledge has nothing to do with it.
This is an opportunity for a clean slate. This is an opportunity, and as Judge Lance suggested, inherent in the Carnes decision is the notice that upon notification that the laws change, he could pull the plug on that.
Why would it be different than the DCAA where actual knowledge does matter?
Because this is a special circumstance. Claims for PTSD are special circumstances. The claim of PTSD is the only claim in the VA system that requires additional corroboration of the event that occurred in service. No other condition requires corroboration of the event. To the extent that a veteran is imposed the additional burden of submitting credible supporting evidence that the allegations made of incurrence actually occurred. Now, because it is different, then it should not be treated the same way as the general or the generic requirements under the DCAA. This court acknowledged that the VA...
So if you were representing a certain veteran down below, made your whole argument, presented it, the VA not actually giving you a separate notice letter, you'd be in court here today telling us that your knowledge and understanding of the law didn't matter because you didn't get a letter, your client didn't get a letter notifying you of these provisions. That's what you're arguing.
That's true. Yes. But that's not the facts of this case.
You're hypothetical, and
in that case, quite frankly, with the change in the law, that may not be an unreasonable standard to apply when lawyers are in after the notice of disagreement and after that initial decision has been made. But the fact of the matter is that you can't, and Mr. Galeos did not have the benefit of counsel and have the opportunity to make the kind of argument that could have been made under 3.304F3 when the law changed. And that's what this is all about. As Judge Lance pointed out, when this court decided Carnes, the notion is that the veteran should not be penalized when there's a change in the law and have to go back and start all over again. What would happen in this case is if Mr. Galeos recognized the change in law, would need to withdraw his claim and submit a new claim in order to get the benefit under the new claim. So that then poses the question of what would be required in the new circumstance. A new
notice. But if the ROD mistake did not give him the notice, got it to render a decision, subsequently got an MOD, the RO issued an SOC, including that information notice, and the veteran who is not represented at all makes the argument, submits additional information, understands it, comes on up here. Ultimately, on appeal, you would take this case and say because you didn't get a separate piece of notice saying that the provisions of this regulation were not provided in a separate piece of notice, actual knowledge did not matter.
Yes, and I would also further suggest that the analysis in the Sanders and Simmons case, which is now on appeal to the Federal Circuit, it, at least at this point, continues to stand for the proposition that the error is to be presumed to be prejudicial.
No, I agree, but actual knowledge usually trumps that. Well, you're saying it doesn't.
Well,
Well, no. What I'm saying is that under Sanders and Simmons, the burden shifts to the government to come forward and show how that actual knowledge should trump it and eliminate the presumption of prejudice. The burden is where it should be on the government. It is the government that decided that this was going to be a special circumstance type claim, and the government also decided that we were going to write a special regulation.
Didn't the government point out in the record the statement of the case, which except that it, for purposes of discussion here, that it did not provide the type of notice that might otherwise put someone on notice, but that the representative specifically argued that the decision was rendered thereafter? I mean, why, that's the normal rebuttal to an adequate notice, actual knowledge. You're saying, again, I want to make it clear, in my mind, that doesn't matter.
Well, number one, I don't think it matters. But number two, under the current law, under Simmons and Sanders, the error is to be presumed prejudicial, and then the burden is supposed to shift to the government.
And showing, if we were to accept that it was actual knowledge, showing that would not have the Secretary carrying his burden.
Well, I don't believe that it would, Your Honor. No, because this is a special circumstance. These PTSD claims are essentially accepted or denied based upon an assessment of whether or not the evidence submitted was credible supporting evidence that the event actually occurred. And this really boils down to what was presented. The ex-wife's statement was what was presented, and it simply didn't arise to the level of credible supporting evidence. What needed to be presented was credible supporting evidence, and I don't believe that Mr. Galeos or his representative were given adequate notice or explanation that the, notwithstanding the fact that they listed out the examples, and if you look at the board decision even on the remand, they focus strictly on behavioral changes. They don't focus on the other things that are talked about in the regulation. Now, this is supposed to be assistance to the veteran, not sabotage.
So to be clear, you're not raising the issue of ineffective representation.
Okay.
I'd like to get back to what you were talking about, prejudice and actual knowledge and how they relate to each other. You, I believe, earlier said that actual knowledge sort of can't overcome the strict liability that VA has to provide this notice. But then you discussed Sanders and talked about that the Secretary has the burden to rebut that there was prejudice, and that one way they can do that is by demonstrating actual knowledge. So let's just pretend that in this case the Secretary, to your satisfaction, had demonstrated that there was actual knowledge. Would that be sufficient under this construct to render this error harmless?
Before you go, would you like to add a minute?
Sure.
If this were a notice situation, the answer is yes. A BCA notice situation.
Right.
This is not a BCA notice situation. This is a difference between a BCA notice and a notice under 3.304F3. And I'm suggesting that that burden is higher, and that actual knowledge proffer would not be sufficient under this.
But a actual knowledge proffer could be in theory.
Theoretically, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, my
brother. Case will be dismissed. We will come down and recap. Let me restate that. Case will be submitted.
Down recess.